The Permanent Fund Corporation has been asking for stability and predictability so that they can plan how they invest.
For the first time ever, the legislature votes to allow draws from the Permanent Fund to pay for state government. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 8th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, officials say they're seeing a resurgence of methamphetamine use in Alaska.
We're seeing the exact same thing. Intravenous drug use, heroin, methamphetamine. We're seeing the same thing as our counterparts down in the lower 48.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
For the first time in the Alaska Permanent Fund's 40-year history, the legislature has adopted a plan to draw money from the fund to pay for state government. Governor Bill Walker says he will sign the bill plan. Supporters say it protects the fund. But as Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports, opponents are concerned about the pressure it could place on permanent fund dividends.
There's been a lot of uncertainty over the $65 billion permanent fund's future. But Nome Democratic Representative Neil Foster says Senate Bill 26 removes that uncertainty. Both legislative chambers passed it Tuesday.
The Permanent Fund Corporation has been asking for stability and predictability so that they can plan how they invest. SB 26 allows that to happen.
Alaska state government is spending about $2.5 billion more than it's bringing in taxes, fees, and oil royalties. And the piggy bank it's used to cover past deficits, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, is almost empty. The bill draws roughly 5% of the fund's market value.
SB 26 does not specify how these funds are to be split. That will be left to future legislatures to determine.
In the Senate, Eagle River Republican Anna McKinnon says limiting the draw prevents the legislature from spending down fund earnings so that dividends disappear.
The bill before us guarantees Alaska's dividends into the future for my children and my grandchildren.
But the effect on PFDs concerns some bill opponents. They're split between Republicans who want deep cuts to state government services and Democrats who want some combination of higher oil and gas taxes and an income tax to shore up the budget. Juneau Democratic Representative Sam Keto III says the state should look at more taxes since Alaska can't rely on oil revenue.
We need to start being adults and figuring out what do we want as a state government, then figuring out how we're going to pay for it instead of continuing to try and milk a cow that right now is, I'm worried about getting way too skinny.
North Pole Republican Representative Tammy Wilson says she's concerned that spending will squeeze out the dividend once the Constitutional Budget Reserve is spent.
I have seen nothing in the history since I have been here that shows that we will be able to stop spending money. And at this point, all I can use is the budget we currently have before us. And with this bill passed as is and no Constitutional Budget Reserve, then there would not be any more than a couple hundred dollars left for the dividend.
Some bill opponents say the only way to protect dividends is to enshrine them in the state constitution. Even with the earnings draw, next year's budget will have a roughly $800 million gap. The legislature will likely turn to the CBR to close the gap, but it won't have that option for many more years. Governor Bill Walker says the bill is an important step. Walker generally takes time to review bills, but he said minutes after the House adopted it, that'll sign it.
You know, it's not something we take lightly. I mean, these are tough, tough decisions. There's no question about it. But, you know, they had to be made.
The bill is a major step toward the legislature finishing its work on the budget and ending the session. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Opioids like heroin get the most attention when you hear about the drug epidemic in Alaska. But people working at the ground level are warning of a parallel problem that's getting worse. Methamphetamine is appearing at the state in greater volumes than ever before, and its negative health impacts are being exacerbated by the wave of opioids. The question is, why is meth surging in Alaska right now? To get the answer, I visited a small one-story house on Main Street in Wasilla. Sitting at his desk, 30-year-old James Savage explains that the first time he used meth, it was to get off painkillers.
I was absolutely miserable in all facets of my life.
Savage was first prescribed pain meds after an injury when he was 19. He's a big guy, and he was given high doses of strong opioids. It started a spiral into addiction as he spent years circulating through pain management clinics. Eventually, his prescription was cut off. And in recent years, as stories of unintended opioid addiction have become more commonplace, this is when most people turn to heroin. But Savage, who hates needles, got advice from a drug buddy that he could detox by using methamphetamines.
So you have a lot of folks that are under the impression that their addiction is bad enough with heroin and they decide to go to methamphetamine to try and wean themselves off of the other.
Savage bypassed the debilitating pain of withdrawal through a days-long meth-induced mania, followed by 2 or 3 days of coma-like sleep. What followed was what he called 7 months of white-knuckle sobriety. Eventually, he relapsed. But instead of opioids, Savage started using meth all day, every day. In 2015, he entered a treatment program and has been in recovery for almost 3 years. Now, he works at Fiend to Clean, a recovery support nonprofit. Savage says that while opioids are getting a lot of attention, meth never left Alaska. And in fact, use of the two drugs together is increasing as users cope with the drowsy narcotic effects that can go along with high doses of opioids.
When you add an upper to a downer like heroin, you have increased duration, or someone who typically passes out or falls asleep after injecting heroin will be able to stay awake as a result of that other chemical in their system. And they'll feel the effects longer without falling asleep or having an adverse reaction to the amount of heroin they're using.
The health calamities associated with meth are rising in Alaska, in large part because it's more potent and because of how it's being used with other drugs. The rate of meth-related overdoses shot up more than 400% in less than a decade. Of the nearly 200 lethal overdoses caused by meth in that period, more than half also involved an opioid like heroin. This is prompting alarm among those closest to the drug problem. Ron Green has spent 3 decades in the treatment field and runs one of the state's only methadone clinics, located in downtown Anchorage.
We see as much methamphetamine use here as we see opiate use in this clinic.
Green forecasted the current heroin crisis as early as 2003, when he saw the drug of choice among people seeking treatment shift away from prescription pills to potent black tar heroin. Now, he says meth is out of control and estimates 60 to 70% of the people getting care at his clinic are either detoxifying from or still actively using meth. He says that's consistent with what similar clinics are seeing outside of Alaska, too.
From the people that are admitted onto all the other methadone clinics, we're seeing the exact same thing. Intravenous drug use, heroin, methamphetamine. We're seeing the same thing as our counterparts down in the lower 48.
Across the country, meth has never been cheaper or more pure than it is right now. Over a decade ago, most meth that reached Alaska was manufactured in small domestic operations inside houses, RVs, and apartments. But since federal legislation in 2006 limited access to many of the essential ingredients, production has moved abroad. According to the Drug Enforcement Administration, nearly all the meth arriving in the U.S. is now made in industrial labs by drug cartels in Mexico. Quality has gone up, even as prices have gone down. Lieutenant Jack Carson with the Anchorage Police Department says these days it's rare to see local mom-and-pop meth operations.
The cost of producing it or buying it that's coming up through Mexico, the price is significantly reduced than trying to get all the precursors here and then manufacture it. So we just don't see that often anymore. What we are seeing is meth coming in bulk from the source states down in the lower 48, coming into the mail system, and then getting distributed down.
For suppliers that can get drugs in, Alaska is an exceptionally lucrative market. Street prices in Anchorage are several times higher than in lower 48 cities, and when drugs move out to smaller bush communities or commercial fishing towns, the price goes up again. Law enforcement agencies say the size of the shipments they've intercepted has risen significantly the last few years, and federal officials don't anticipate the trend reversing anytime soon. Governor Bill Walker's chief oil and gas advisor has taken a new job. Later this month, John Hendricks will join the Nana Regional Corporation as president of its commercial group. Hendricks has been in Walker's cabinet for nearly 2 years. When he was hired in 2016 for the six-figure position, his focus was on figuring out how Alaska can produce more oil. Walker's office says Hendricks will continue working on projects with the office of the governor. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, veteran Native American journalist Mark Trahan discusses the past and future of Indigenous journalism.
When I first started coming up here, there were Native on television, there were Natives in radio across the state, not just in pockets.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association's 10th Annual Conference and Board Meeting is May 10th and 11th in Anchorage at the Egan Center. Learn about new developments and opportunities from Alaska's business leaders, network with Alaska Native Corporation executives, and hear from the nation's top figures in Native contracting and small business. Agenda and registration at anvca.biz. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association.
After a heated debate, the Fairbanks City Council approved an ordinance Monday that added regulations to the marijuana industry. The amended ordinance maintains the city's ban on on-site consumption of cannabis, but it would allow more than twice as many retail shops as the original measure introduced by Mayor Jim Matherly. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The council chambers were once again packed with partisans for and against a marijuana regulating ordinance introduced by Mayor Jim Matherly 3 months ago. But this time it was the council members' turn to talk as they debated a flurry of amendments to the ordinance, starting with a provision limiting the number of retail shops in the city to 12. Matherly says he chose that number because that's how many of the shops were operating or about to open.
9 were open, 3 were in the queue. That's where I originally started with the 12 to get it on the table for discussion.
Jerry Cleworth said the substitute ordinance that he and June Rogers introduced set the limit at 15 based on the principle that marijuana ought to be regulated like alcohol, as legalized marijuana supporters have long advocated.
Right now inside the city, we have 15 operating package stores, which is the equivalent to a retail establishment for cannabis.
Valerie Therrien moved to amend the substitute ordinance to eliminate the limit and to delete a provision that would require the city to reduce that number to 11 over time.
We don't need to put a number on the number of establishments that we need to have in our community. I believe that zoning is going to take care of that.
Council members approved that proposal 5-1, with Cleworth dissenting. Therrien then moved to increase the retail store limit to 25. She says that would be fair for the 6 shops now in business, as well as the 3 that are close to opening, and 16 others that have submitted applications and are under review by the State Alcohol and Marijuana Control Office.
I don't think that it was fair to the marijuana industry to limit the number of licenses after people had already initiated and spent their money, and now say to them, oh, we're going to cut it down to 15.
After a lengthy debate, the council narrowly approved setting the limit at 25, with Cleworth, Rogers, and Jonathan Bagwell voting no, and Joy Huntington, David Pruse, and Therrien voting yes, with Matherly casting the 4th and tie-breaking affirmative vote. Pruse and Therrien also prevailed in a vote to eliminate a proposal to establish a new method of measuring the minimum buffer of 750 feet between a marijuana retail shop and residential areas, schools, and rehab facilities. Their amendment reestablished the use of the borough's simpler method of measuring buffers from property line to property line. But they did not succeed in convincing the council to go along with a provision to authorize establishments to allow consumption of marijuana on site. Pruse told marijuana advocates at the meeting that that's unlikely to happen anytime soon.
No one on this council has a taste for having on-site consumption. It's not legal in the state of Alaska. It's not legal in Fairbanks.
But in the end, the council approved the amended ordinance 6-0. And afterward, Matherly suggested to all in attendance that they may not have heard the last word on the issue.
This is not the last you'll see of this ordinance, I'm sure, and the discussions surrounding it, just so everyone knows.
But for now, the city's marijuana industry has, for the first time, a complete set of rules under which to operate. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
The National Weather Service is automating weather balloon launches in Alaska. It's part of a shift that'll concentrate staff at the agency's urban forecast offices. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The National Weather Service's first automated weather balloon launcher came online in Kodiak last fall, and the second recently went into service in Fairbanks. Outside what looks part RV, part Mars base station, National Weather Service meteorologist Ed Plum described steps leading up to a balloon launch.
This beeping starts about 15 minutes before the balloon's going to release, and this is indicating that there's hydrogen now flowing and filling up the balloon.
The $700,000 robot sits on a gravel pad near Fairbanks International Airport, the same location where twice-daily launches have occurred for decades. The new automated launcher responds to the push of a button at the Weather Service's Fairbanks headquarters 5 miles away, sparing staff from twice-daily trips to manually deploy the atmospheric data-gathering balloons. Plum says meteorologists will use the freed-up time to work more closely with government agency and industry customers.
So the Weather Service has sort of shifted its paradigm, and this is just a little piece where it gives us more time to do that sort of mission.
Our plan is to reinvest these positions and reinvest the people.
Weather Service Regional Director Carvin Scott says positions eliminated by auto launchers at 11 rural Weather Service offices will shift to forecast stations in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau.
We will lose some observational capability at these WSOs.
For things like snowfall and ice accumulation and any unique type of events.
Jim Brader is a longtime agency meteorologist in Fairbanks and Alaska chair of the National Weather Service Employees Organization, which takes issue with the automation and downsizing of rural Alaska offices.
We basically are spending $17 million in Alaska to outsource 30 jobs across rural Alaska where jobs are highly needed and reducing services to rural Alaska too.
The Weather Service's Scott counters that the balloon launch technology needs upgrade and that it's a struggle to staff the agency's remote offices.
Much easier to fill a position in Fairbanks, Juneau, and Anchorage than it is in Kotzebue or McGrath.
Scott claims the Weather Service is not abandoning rural Alaska and plans to keep one paid caretaker at each station and train up a base of local volunteer observers.
To help us have eyes in the villages to report on a severe weather event.
Additional stations scheduled for downsize and transition to automated weather balloon launchers this summer include those at Annette Island, Yakutat, Ukiavik, St. Paul, and Bethel. Alaska's six other stations will convert the following year. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com.
Scientists use lots of expensive sensors and satellites for studying climate change in Alaska, but more and more, they're also relying on something that's a lot more low-tech, traditional ecological knowledge. Brian Brentschneider, with our Ask a Climatologist segment, says traditional knowledge involves getting out into communities to ask residents for their climate observations and experiences. Brentschneider says in Alaska, it's considered best practice to use traditional knowledge in climate research.
I like to think of the climate system as a puzzle, and we have lots of pieces to the puzzle. And some of those pieces are thermometers, and some of them are satellite images and river gauges. And we put those pieces together in the puzzle, and we can kind of start to get an idea for what the system looks like. But there are more pieces. And so if we go to the communities and we ask, you know, hey, where do ice jams form? And, you know, when did the brush start to move in, or when did the permafrost thaw out? Now, those are more pieces of the puzzle. As we add all those in, you know, we get a more complete, better idea for what the climate is for a location.
And are there types of information that traditional knowledge is really well suited for?
Well, I think like all kinds of measurements, you know, there are some that are going to be more reliable and some that maybe aren't so much. But for example, locations of where certain events happen, you know, again, like where does an ice jam form? Where does snow stick around farther into the spring? To things like, you know, when did or what's the permafrost been like in an area? Where and when does the sea ice set up? When does river breakup occur? So there's a lot of things that that we can glean from the traditional knowledge that there's really no other way to get that information and get an idea for what the climate of an area is like.
And are there things that it doesn't work as well for?
Well, I think, if you say, well, can you recall, you know, is someone in your community remember, you know, what the winter of 1922 was like, you know? And there may be someone that has some information on that. You know, maybe they can. That was a year where they burned through all their firewood, and so that would be one way to assess. You know, was that a cold winter or not? But you know, some recollections are going to be better suited for some types of observations than others.
Is there an example of a study that really benefited from traditional knowledge?
There certainly is. So I think a really good example is up on the North Slope. You know, there was a time when they thought bowhead whales were really kind of critically endangered and maybe only numbered in the hundreds. But the local Inupiat hunters up from the North Slope communities really had a better feel for what those whale population numbers were like. And they worked with, say, for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to kind of come up with a new way to track populations. And it turns out they were correct, that those numbers were quite a bit larger than what was originally thought. So that's an example of two groups kind of working together to come up with a better way to view the Earth and climate system.
And over your career as a scientist in Alaska, especially, how have you seen this evolve?
Well, it's really, you know, it's kind of transitioned over the last, you know, maybe 20 years or so, where it was kind of at one time kind of viewed as kind of an afterthought, as an add-on, but it really has become an integral part to studying remote areas in Alaska and all of the Arctic North. And so if members of a community are willing to work with the scientists, and the scientists are willing to work with them and respect the knowledge and treat it with respect and integrity, there's a lot of mutual benefit to using this data to better understand the world we live in.
Brian Brentschneider is a climatologist based in Anchorage with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He checks in with Alaska's Energy Desk each week as part of a regular look at climate change in the state. If you have a climate-related question, please send an email to akenergydesk@alaskapublic.org. Last week, KYUK in Bethel got a visit from Mark Trahant, the new managing editor of Indian Country Today. A longtime independent journalist, Trahant has been coming to Alaska for decades and served as a college professor in Anchorage. KYUK's Christine Trudeau sat down with Trahant for a talk about the past, present, and future of Alaska journalism.
No stranger to reporting in Alaska, Mark Trahant served for 2 years as the University of Alaska Anchorage's Atwood Chair of Journalism. Trahant is a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribes of Idaho and first reported in Alaska during the Exxon Valdez oil spill in 1989 while working for the Arizona Republic. Since then, he's returned every few years. 2011 found Trahant reporting for PBS's Frontline on childhood sexual abuse by Catholic priests in St. Michael's, in the episode titled The Silence. Trahant is back in the YK Delta for a new show coming to First Nations Experience, or FNX-TV, called Wasaha.
Wasaha is really a storied name in Native journalism. It was originally a newspaper by Carlos Montezuma in the 1920s, and later again became a national newspaper in the 1970s, published in San Francisco.
The name was chosen to bring the indigenous journalistic legacy to the forefront. A 10-episode season is slated to premiere on May 31st. The first episode, titled She Represents, focuses on Native American women running for public office.
This year could be the big year. Since 1790, the first year there was a Congress, there are a little over almost 11,000 men who've been elected to Congress. It's interesting, one-third of all the women who've ever been elected to Congress serve now. And of course, in that time, there's never, ever been a Native American woman. We're still talking about the first.
But the story Trahant came to Bethel for is not about Alaska Native women running for Congress, something both Georgiana Lincoln and Diane Benson have done in past years. This year, Trahant's YK Delta story will focus on the success of the Dental Health Therapist Program. It will be Episode 7. Trahant has also taken on the role of editor for Indian Country Today, formerly Indian Country Today Media, and once the Lakota Times. Trahant will relaunch the national online news site under the ownership of the National Congress of American Indians, or NCAI.
This is really exciting, I think, because it's a chance to take a legacy, something, a name of Indian Country Today, and say, how can we do journalism different and do it for the 21st century?
Trahant says the workforce of Native American journalists has changed down through the years. At one time, he saw Alaska in the forefront.
When I first started coming up here, kind of the network of Howard Rock was still alive. There was people who had worked at the Daily News. There was a member of the editorial board at the Daily News. They were Native on television. There were Natives in radio across the state, not just in pockets.
But in the decline of newspapers, Native journalism in Alaska fragmented, he says. Now, though, Trahant sees a national groundswelling in the young generation.
What's different from perhaps my generation is when I was president of NAJA, Native American Journal Association, many, many years ago, most of the people coming up wanted to work for mainstream media and to actually get the big paychecks and to do the stuff in the limelight. You know, now people want to serve Native communities and they want to figure out ways to have a career, do good journalism, and serve Native readers and listeners. And I think that's really cool.
But it could be that many of the biggest stories emerging for Indian Country will actually be taking place on the national stage as a conservative administration and Congress seek to cut back funding for social programs without always recognizing that Native Americans are not just another racial minority in this country.
And so whether it's the Indian Health Service or Medicaid or them working together or the Veterans Administration, all of that is the United States fulfilling its treaty obligation. And I think that's one thing that we as journalists can do is to hold accountable that. It says the United States promises, what are you doing about it? And kind of reminding people.
To listen to our full interview with Native journalist Mark Trahant, visit our website at kyuk.org. In Bethel, I'm Christine Trudeau.
Is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Christine Trudeau in Bethel, and Annie Fite in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at matson.com. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the Federal Plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.